Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, January 20th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today on the show, we're talking foreign policy. You might have heard about Greenland, an island in the North Atlantic. President Trump says America will possess Greenland. By what means? We're not sure. Speaking of the North Atlantic, Greenland is a part of Denmark. Denmark is a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, known as NATO. And Trump's belligerent attitude toward Greenland could, some say, break up the alliance that is NATO. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about Venezuela. And we're going to talk about whatever you want to talk about on the foreign policy front this hour with a couple of great guests who are experts in all of these matters. We're going to whisk around the globe, and we are asking you the following question this hour. What do you think about how U.S. foreign policy is shifting under Trump? Call 888-477-9499 with your thoughts. Email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and today, by the way, marks 1 year to the day that President Donald Trump was sworn in as president of the United States for the second time. So we'd love to get your thoughts about how U.S. foreign policy is shifting under this president. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at WHYY.org.
And speaking of swearing in.
Yes, Mikey.
Swearing's in.
It's happening right now. Mikey Sherrill was actually sworn in as New Jersey's 57th governor just a few moments ago. She will replace Democrat Phil Murphy, who served two consecutive terms. That ceremony is taking place as we speak in Newark, New Jersey, where history is being made because Sherrill is the first Democrat to secure her party a third consecutive term in the governor's office in 65 years. A former Navy helicopter pilot, she is the first woman veteran to be a U.S. governor and the first Democratic woman to be elected New Jersey governor. Sherrill is a wife and mother of four, and she said she would declare a state of emergency to freeze high energy rates in New Jersey on day one. So constituents are expecting to hear more about that today, right? Because today is officially day one.
Today's the day.
She's also promised to pay attention to the entire state. She spent her birthday, which was the King Day of Service yesterday, in South Jersey. She visited sites in Camden and Trenton. And her lieutenant governor is Dale Caldwell, also sworn in today. He just spoke before constituents. He is president of a small college in Jersey. He's also pastor of a church in Plainfield and comes from a civil rights family. She's appointed about half a dozen people to her cabinet. So, and we're going to be talking about this tomorrow on the show.
And whenever we talk Jersey, our guests remind us that the governor of New Jersey is extraordinarily powerful.
Oh, yes.
Compared to other governors, they have a wide latitude in terms of appointments. So it'll be interesting to have that conversation tomorrow to see what are the big challenges confronting Sherrill, what she'll keep from Murphy, what she'll ditch. And of course, we're going to hear from you tomorrow during that conversation.
Our Jersey folks definitely would like to weigh in.
Absolutely.
Whenever we talk New Jersey politics.
Love to weigh.
Mm-hmm.
New Jerseyans.
They love to weigh.
They're the weighing type.
They're the weighing. I like that. Yes.
Okay. Let's move back across the bridge now to Pennsylvania. As you probably know, the cost of getting health care through the Affordable Care Act has increased significantly ever since federal subsidies expired at the end of the year. One of the big questions, how many people will forego health insurance now that the price has gone up? Well, we're starting to get some answers to that question here in Pennsylvania. The Inquirer reports that 70,000 people so far have dropped the coverage that they had through Penny, the state's health care exchange. Now, the enrollment period is not over yet. Mm-hmm. It lasts through the end of the month. Folks could still drop coverage after that, even if they sign up right now. So this is really preliminary data. So the 70,000 number is a number that's very much in flux, but it gives us a little bit of a sense of where this might be heading in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, because they had anticipated twice that more than twice that would leave, but we'll see. You know, Congress has failed so far to strike a deal to bring the tax credits back. There have been talk about, you know, a big vote on this. I think the U.S. House did approve legislation, but we don't know what's going to happen with the Senate. And President Donald Trump had talked about a plan that would basically, you know, control some healthcare costs and give subsidies to consumers. But how it would all work is not clear. I think it's just being kicked to Congress to sort of figure it out. Meanwhile, folks all over the country, including in Pennsylvania, they have to make real choices, right? They're looking at the bottom line. They're looking at the budget. They're like, do I pay for the high cost of healthcare? Do I go in debt for it? Do I downsize or make other financial sacrifices? Or do I take the risk and not have health care at all? And 70,000 people and counting in Pennsylvania have made that decision.
Yeah, and that top line number is just that. It's a top line number. Below that, you want to know, who are those 70,000 people?
Yeah.
Are they relatively healthy? Chances are yes, because the people that would forego health insurance, the people willing to make that trade-off, mm-hmm. are probably thinking, I won't need this health insurance over the next year. So how does that affect the entire pool, right? If it's a sicker pool of patients mm-hmm. who are left behind.
Taking prices up, yeah.
And then you mentioned the other thing, which is the people who stay in, who are not part of that 70,000, what other economic sacrifices are they making to continue to pay for health insurance? So that's all worth monitoring going forward. And you mentioned that the House mm-hmm. passed a deal to try to extend these subsidies, and three Pennsylvanians vote on the Republican side voted for those subsidies, all in pretty vulnerable districts, including Brian Fitzpatrick of Bucks County in Pennsylvania, which leads us to
our third story. Yes, that Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick, he did a rare sit down local news interview with Tom McGrath of Philadelphia Magazine. In it, this moderate conservative from Bucks County, as you mentioned, he takes issue with the American political party system. Just generally, Fitzpatrick, if you hadn't heard, he's been ranked the most bipartisan member of Congress, but he believes this two-party system sucks and it totally needs to go away. In this interview, which is fairly lengthy, by the way, he also wasn't shy about his feelings about President Donald Trump. He admitted that he did not vote for him in 2016 or in 2024. Instead, he penciled in Mike Pence and then Nikki Haley in those elections. Yeah. He also has said that Trump's appeasement of Russian President Putin lacks, quote, moral clarity. He also commented about the state of the FBI. It was a wide-wielding interview where Congressman Fitzpatrick talked about a lot of things. And it made clear that he's really kind of struggling and grappling on how to move forward in a system that he truly believes is broken.
Yeah. And the news here partially is that he did the interview at all.
Yeah.
Which you mentioned. And it's unfortunate that it's news that a longtime congressman would sit down with a local news outlet and explain his positions on things. But that is where we are. I do have some sympathy for the fact that he does very few interviews, because as he states in the piece, and he's not entirely wrong about this, many interviews get clipped and cut mm-hmm. and used out of context in attack ads, and it is genuinely difficult to be a sort of keep your head down moderate in Congress and also do interviews. I get that part of it. At the same time, of course, you know, as a journalist and as an interested member of the public.
And we have tried to get him to come here on Studio 2,
you know,
for the record.
We're trying to, obviously, we're trying to make an environment where those types of interviews are possible and productive. But it's an interesting, you mentioned that he wrote in Pence and Haley and mm-hmm. didn't vote for Trump. And one of the big criticisms of Fitzpatrick is that he does stuff like that all the time, sort of performative breaks with the party that mean nothing. Mm-hmm. So you didn't vote for the Democrat. You didn't vote. You didn't cast a vote, even one vote that could, you know, genuinely help the other party defeat Donald Trump. You did something that was a gesture, right?
Yeah. And the Big Beautiful Bill was an example, because he voted to approve the bill initially, but then when the big vote happened, he voted against it. And so people kind of,
even though it didn't tip the balance.
Exactly. So people kind of see him as somebody who plays both sides, but he's very vulnerable.
Because
you know, he has a target on his back in his purple Bucks County district from the Democrats, but also he's not you know, someone who Trump necessarily likes. Yep. So that makes him vulnerable from the Republican side as well.
But it's interesting, too, that Republicans have never seriously tried to primary him.
No, and they haven't called him out by name specifically.
Exactly. And it actually goes to the purpose of having purple districts and not gerrymandering everything. Republicans understand that there's no one else in their party that could carry this district besides mm-hmm. him, besides Brian Fitzpatrick, right? And so they tolerate his centrism.
Both sides of it, yeah.
Right, they tolerate and they don't tolerate centrism from Republicans in other districts. Mm-hmm. And so I think his political survival is a testament to the fact that, at least in Pennsylvania, we still have
purple districts,
some contested districts.
And he says he's going to do this job as long as he can.
Same for us. We're going to keep doing our job as long as we can. At least one more hour. We're going to talk about U.S. foreign policy shifts under Trump. We want your opinion. 888-477-9499, studio 2 at WHYY.org. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Leaders are meeting in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum this week. Dominating the conference is President Trump's mounting pressure to acquire Greenland. Trump arrives Wednesday, but has already mocked allies and threatened EU countries with tariffs if they don't support his plans for the autonomous territory. Today, he said that, quote, there is no going back on his plans to control the island, and he even posted an AI-generated image of himself planting an American flag on it.
And all this focus on Greenland comes just after deposing Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro and threatening military action against Iran amid the violent crackdown on protests there. This is all part of what Trump has called the Monroe Doctrine, his version of the Monroe Doctrine, a more assertive foreign policy. But what does this mean for U.S. national security and global stability? And what message does it send to allies and to adversaries?
Perhaps we should ask those questions to some experts. Yeah. Joining us this hour to talk through all of that is Bobby Ghosh, a columnist who writes on geo-global politics for Foreign Affairs and Time. Bobby, welcome to the program. And while we get Bobby's microphone up and working, let me also welcome Felicia Schwartz, diplomatic correspondent for Politico. Felicia, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's a crazy day over here in Washington.
Indeed it is. Our question for all of you listening is this. Mm-hmm. What do you think about U.S. foreign policy and its shift under Trump? Call 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat.
And so 1 year to the day since Trump was sworn in for his second term presidency. And, you know, President Donald Trump has embraced a more openly coercive foreign policy. So I want you to both to give us an idea of the big picture. What do you think overall has been the biggest shift that you've seen in America's foreign policy approach under Trump? I want you to do a big picture. And Felicia, we'll start with you and then we'll go to Bobby.
I think the biggest shift is that Trump has a completely different outlook on the U.S. system of partnerships and alliances. The Biden administration, for example, that came before Trump, really made a priority to try and rebuild these partnerships, to do things in coalition. I think the Trump administration is kind of rebalancing that. I think they feel like they want to work with other countries, but in a way that not as equal partners, that the U.S. is the most powerful country in the world and it can assert itself accordingly. So there's a whole security architecture of international relationships and alliances that was crafted after World War II. And Trump has really kind of taken a carver and a chisel to it, or you know, if he's carving it like an ice sculpture, he's really changing it around. It doesn't feel like the U.S. is kind of treating its allies as equals or as equal partners, at least, but that, you know, America can throw its weight around in the way that's like most beneficial to it. And it's up to everyone else to come along.
Yeah. Keep up with us, basically. Bobby, your thoughts on how you see the big picture shift under Trump?
Well, I'll take what Felicia says and expand on it a little bit. I think Trump's view of the world, Trump's view of life, is might is right. And I think his foreign policy really is an expression of that idea. If there is such a thing as a Trump doctrine, then that is it. That might is right. America is the biggest power in the world, the biggest military power, the strongest economic power, and therefore it gets to say what it wants. And of course, the corollary with that is that Trump thinks of himself as America. What's good for Trump is good for America, not the other way around necessarily. And so he basically is the instrument through which American power must be exercised around the world. There's no national appetite for a land grab in Greenland, but Trump wants it. And if Trump wants it, it follows that America wants it. I think those are the two core principles. Might is right, and Trump is America.
So he's going to come face to face with a lot of these other world leaders this week in Switzerland, and they're already making comments and making big speeches. I want to read a couple of quotes from Mark Carney, who's the Prime Minister of Canada, spoke already at Davos. First quote is, "I will talk today about the breaking of the world order, the end of a pleasant fiction, and the beginning of a brutal reality where the geopolitics of the great powers is not subject to any constraint." Later, Carney said, "We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition." Look, we can always risk being prisoners of the moment, right, Bobby, and overstating what's happening. Is Carney overstating what's happening here, or are we actually seeing the post-World War II global order rupture?
I don't think he's overstating it at all. I think he's showing courage in saying what many people are thinking. He runs a country that is directly on America's borders. America's largest borders is with Canada. He feels the rupture personally, and in ways that people who are separated from us by an ocean might not do. So if you're Macron or Starmer or Mertz, your European leader, you might still, if you squint hard enough, imagine that the old order can be saved. I think if you are living on America's borders, that polite fiction, I think is what he called it, cannot be sustained. And so I think he's absolutely right. He's right to say that middle powers like Canada no longer have the voice they have in world affairs. It is a great power competition. And I think what he means by that is America, China, and Russia. What he did not say, I think he's counting on people with long enough memories and those who read history to understand, is that the last time there was great power competition, it ended up in the First World War and not long thereafter in the Second World War. So the world collectively, we've seen this movie before. It does not go well.
But I guess the squinting here that you referenced would involve squinting past Trump, right? To say, look, Trump is an older gentleman. He, according to the Constitution, has just 3 more years left in office. And really that no one else is really along for the ride with Trump on breaking down the global order, or no one who will have power beyond the next 3 years. Felicia, is that a fair squint, or do you agree with Bobby that this is basically the end and we're going into, you know, global competition amongst the global powers?
I think it's a hopeful squint. I think Trump has had quite an effect on the Republican foreign policy and the Republican Party as a whole. And I think, you know, the midterms that are coming up this year will be the first test of whether Trumpism extends to Trump. But at least right now, the top two contenders to replace him are, you know, his Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio and his Vice President J.D. Vance, who have both proven instrumental in pushing these policies along. So I think that would probably be a mistake to discount whether, you know, just to say, okay, Trump will disappear and these policies will go away. I mean, maybe Greenland, for example, is pretty personal to Trump, and perhaps someone who replaced him wouldn't put as much emphasis on it.
Right.
But I do think that J.D. Vance, for example, is really a voice of kind of isolationism and America first.
But is there not a tension between isolationism and sort of trying to build world power and be the bully of the world? Like, it does feel like fundamentally there's something a little bit different about those two points of view. So maybe if you could expand, Felicia, do you see daylight between a Vancean view of the world and a Trumpian view of the world that, if we project past the next 3 years, could be consequential?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And one of the things that's really interesting right now is a lot of Trump's expansionist foreign policy is not polling well. Like the Greenland stuff is really not working with his base, and Venezuela also. So I think that it is true that, if Trump really won over a lot of voters in 2024 who felt like the US was doing too much on the world stage, and is so I guess the short answer is yes, these things are in complete contradiction with each other. I think that's kind of sometimes the challenge of understanding Trump and his effect on the Republican policy is that it's very, very personal to him. And I think we could expect some change. I guess the addendum there being that if this kind of brand of personality and power foreign policy kind of works well, maybe someone like J.D. Vance would continue it.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Brian in Morristown, New Jersey, who says, once again, Trump is just proving that he only concern his only concerns is his, are his himself. His narcissism and ego have no moral bounds. He campaigned on America First and staying out of foreign conflicts, but that was just an obvious ploy just to get people to vote for him. Now he's in office. It's all and only about what he wants. And we kind of touched on this idea of Trump's foreign policy being very personal to him. And so I want to sort of like look forward and sort of tie some of the ideas that have been bubbling up here because even though his foreign policy seems very personal, are there things that he is doing right now that could be irreversible or at least very much be, have a huge impact on the next few administrations, regardless of who steps into power. And I'm thinking about how his treatment of allies could have a ripple effect for administrations to come. Bobby.
Well, I think if you look at just the foreign policy, and that's the lens through which I tend to see the administration and the wider world, you have to look at the enormous structural damage he has done to American institutions that have anything to do with foreign policy. So the State Department, first and foremost, but all kinds of other American government instruments that are around foreign policy, USAID, and other things like that. And that damage is structural. It's not like the next president can arrive, snap his fingers, and overnight all these professionals who were laid off will simply leave whatever else they're doing and make a beeline to go back to their jobs at the State Department. I don't think that's happening. I think there's a breakdown of trust. We've talked about the breakdown of trust with our allies and alliances. There's also a breakdown of trust between people who used to work for the government and the government itself. If you were working in the State Department, you spent 30 years, 40 years serving your country, you expected that no matter who the president was, no matter how strident his views about the department, that the institutions, that the government would protect you, that your job would be valued, your contributions would be valued, and you'd be, if not rewarded tremendously, because let's not forget these are not high-paid jobs, but you would be regarded as somebody who did right by his country. That compact has broken down. And I don't think that if tomorrow there was another president, whether that is Vance, whether that is a Democratic president, if I were working in the State Department and I lost my job, I'm not going to take a chance and just go back. Because let's not forget, Trump or no Trump, one of the two major parties in this country believes that everybody who works for the government really is a moocher, is sort of feeding off the taxpayers' dime and not doing their job right. And they're particularly the GOPs, particularly and longstanding. This goes back several Republican presidents has put a target on the back of the State Department. Trump is only the latest iteration of that overall policy of the government of the Republican Party. So the structural damage he's done to the State Department and other parts of the government that deal with the wider world, that's not going to change overnight. And again, you look at it on the other side,
And that's what I
those
was.
countries used to dealing with America now, will they ever trust us again, no matter who the president is?
And that was the second part of my question. And I'd love to hear your thoughts, Felicia, because Bobby's talking about the internal structures and how they've their change probably for many years to come. The external structures that we were talking about that has been the world order for the past 100 years have now shifted. But I mean, how will this impact future presidents? Because he's only going to be in office 3 more years. But now our allies must view us very different.
I think just, you know, if we think about NATO, for example, this is an alliance that it was designed that the U.S. would be at the top of it, right? That they would have a leadership role. Just the fact that Trump is, you know, I mean, he's openly threatening war within the alliance over Greenland. I think, you know, privately, American officials will try to assure their European counterparts, okay, there's not really, you know, it's not really going to be a war. It's like tough talk from him. But just questioning, like the whole point is, you know, an attack on one NATO ally is an attack on all of them. So even the idea that, like, you know, American internal politics allows for this open conversation that one ally would attack another completely weakens the whole prospect. I mean, this is great for Russia. This is great for China. They, you know, they have kind of an adversarial foreign policy to the U.S. They don't want the U.S. to be the leader anymore. And I think while Trump has kind of carved out this global order where he's kind of comfortable to have control of, say, you know, the Western Hemisphere and China can have Asia and Russia can have Europe or whatever he, you know, however it goes. That in itself is just, even if he doesn't think it's a good idea, there's been like a global consensus in the Western world that this is the safest way to protect America. So I think it just fundamentally weakened going forward, because now you kind of know that America is not or can't be counted on in the same way. Mm.
Let me read this comment from Drew in Devon. And by the way, our question today, we want to know what you think about the foreign policy shifts in the first year of Trump 2.0, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Drew from Devon says, it seems to me that the Trump administration is under the belief that America's power should be used to dominate rather than deter. It's a pretty radical move from the post-World War II era of NATO and deterrence. I think they also believe, probably correctly, that if we move toward this view of America, that a democracy will no longer work and we will need to be an autocratic country. I'm wondering if the idea of democracy in the U.S. has run its course. That's Drew's thoughts. Let's take this example of Greenland, Felicia, and let's imagine it through the lens of this emerging world order where America is sort of set apart from the rest of NATO, and America is really looking out for its own interests, and the other NATO countries have to do something else. What is that something else in the case of Greenland? Let's look at the middle powers. Like, what can Canada and France and the UK and Germany actually do in this situation with Greenland? And, you know, what's the most realistic path when you look at their menu of options here?
So, like, just let's take the EU, for example. Yeah. As a bloc, the second largest economy in the world as a group, second to the US, they have a lot of financial power that they could throw around. I mean, the total trade between the US and the EU is, you know, I think it's like $2 trillion or something like that. So this would be, this is something obviously that the EU doesn't want to do, but they have all kinds of economic levers. I think there's been some conversations at Davos now about the EU as a bloc being willing to use its power more coercively. We could see that. I think, you know, there's also been some quiet conversation about withholding or restricting American access to bases in Europe. On the one hand, Europe's whole security architecture counts on the US. You know, it's got the largest military, So on the one hand, you know, that would potentially be bad for Europe, but the U.S. also really relies on Europe as a jumping off point to have access to the Middle East, to Asia, you know, other parts of the world. So it would also potentially be bad for the U.S. to have a more adversarial relationship, particularly with Europe, but also, you know, if we think about Asia, you know, they're not, I think that they're kind of keeping their heads down, but, these alliances do serve the U.S. And I think up until now, all of these countries have not really wanted to force a rupture, but they definitely have tools they could use.
Bobby, do you think they're likely to use those tools in this case? I mean, this is a little bit of mutually assured economic destruction, right? It's not like Europe gets off scot-free if they, you know, impose huge tariffs on U.S. trade. So do you think that's the most likely response if indeed Trump pushes the Greenland situation to a breaking point? Some sort of economic sanctions, tariffs, or however you want to define that sort of economic maneuver?
Well, he doesn't think they will. He's counting on, yeah, on the Europeans to back down at the last minute. But, you know, those tools were put in place for a reason. And if not now, then when? If a European country, Denmark, loses a large chunk of its territory because of the United States, then those instruments that are there to protect the Europeans and to punish anybody who gets in, who sort of tries to redraw borders like that, they're there for that reason. And the Europeans are beginning to sound quite serious, more serious than I've heard them in the context of Ukraine and Russia, even.
Yeah.
And that's something to be taken seriously. I don't think, and there is also a sense that Trump respects strength, that he only respects people who stand up to him. So there is the consensus that is growing in Europe that it's time to stand up to Trump. The big problem, of course, of the EU is that it is not really always a unified bloc.
Mm-hmm. That was going to be my question. Does all of this push Western Europe closer together? And then as a bloc, does it push them closer to, say, a China? We saw Canada and China strike a type of trade agreement. I think that's a two-parter, Bobby, but does it congeal Western Europe more as sort of acting with one spirit or one heart? And does it take that one spirit, one heart Europe and push them toward another global superpower?
Well, the problem is that the EU is not just Western Europe. The countries in Eastern Europe, which yeah. are very much within the zone of influence of Russia, whose leaders are pro-Russian, pro-Trump even. I'm thinking of Hungary's Viktor Orban as one example, not the only one. The problem is that the EU has dissension in its own ranks. And so it's okay for Macron and Merz and to say one thing, but it's not at all certain that they can bring their entire union together on this, and the various members of the union have the ability to put the kibosh on any group action. So that's the big test, and we won't know the answer to that until we come to that bridge. Will they make more advances towards other countries? Well, you know, that's the whole point of the world order breaking down. Every country, every group of countries has to now look out for itself. I don't think it is entirely to Canada's advantage to have a close relationship with China. Certainly they're not going to get one like the one they used to have with the United States. But if the U.S. takes that old deal off the table, then Canada is going to have to look elsewhere for it. And so we're pushing these countries to make these deals. They're not making them out of voluntarily, out of a sense of their own necessity, or their best interest. They're doing them because we're making them make these deals. We're forcing them into the arms of our geopolitical rivals. And if they now say, look, you pushed us hard enough and we're not going to take it anymore, we only have ourselves to blame.
Yeah, Matt says, most media reports I hear report on those against the acquisition of Greenland. He says, I tend to agree, but I would also like to hear why it may be a good idea. Digging deeper into the national security argument or some other reasons, I don't think that Donald Trump came to his advisors one day and said, let's take Greenland. Someone must have come up with this and for some reason. So I'm hoping that we kind of dig into that a little bit. I know we're coming up on a break, but Matt has this question. Also, Ann says, why is everyone ignoring what seems to be obvious motives for acquiring Greenland? Just like Venezuela, he and his administration claim one ridiculous objective in order to persuade the voting public that they are virtuous when their intent is enrichment for themselves and their cronies. So okay. Lots of questions.
Yeah, so we'll dig into some of the nuts and bolts of this Greenland push on the other side of this break. We're talking with Bobby Ghosh, columnist on Geo-Global Politics, who writes for Foreign Affairs and Time, and Felicia Schwartz, diplomatic correspondent for Politico. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Keep those comments coming. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Our question is this: what do you think about the U.S. foreign policy shifts under Trump? Again, 888-477-9499. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we're talking about U.S. foreign policy and the shift under the Trump administration. With us are Bobby Ghosh, columnist on geo-global politics, who write for Foreign Affairs and Time, and Felicia Schwartz, diplomatic correspondent for Politico.
Our question for you this hour, what do you think about how U.S. foreign policy is shifting under Trump? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat.
And so before the break, we had multiple listeners sort of asking the question about the motive for a Greenland takeover, so to speak. So I want to get your take, Felicia. Is Greenland about security, or is it about leverage, or is it about dominance? What is it really about?
I think the best explanation is Trump himself. He gave an interview to the New York Times, I believe, last week, and they asked him, you know, why is do you feel like you need to own Greenland? Can you work out anything else? And he basically said, like, psychologically, ownership is what I need. I believe one of the listeners also asked who put this idea into Trump's head. It was a donor. His name is Ronald Lauder. It came up in the first Trump term. Lauder, I believe, has some investments in the Arctic, and he wrote, if you're interested in this, he wrote an opinion piece in the New York Post not too long ago outlining his reasons. I think there is a security argument, and there is an argument about critical minerals, but I think for Trump and his team, those are things that they're saying to explain it. But I think, you know, Trump is someone who is thinking a lot about his legacy. He really admired James Polk, I believe. And he wants, I think that he has some desire to exercise American power and look about expansion. I think it's psychological for him. That was his answer when he was asked the question. So I think we should take that at face value, even though I guess I would caveat that I think he does like to kind of say outlandish things. I think he likes that he's set up a fight with Europe at Davos. On the one hand, some of this is a negotiating tactic. I think some of this is a strategy to kind of throw America's weight around. But he does just have this, like, deeply held belief now that the U.S. needs to own it.
Yeah.
And by the way, Ronald Lauder, for those who don't know, is the heir to the Estee Lauder fortune. So he is a cosmetics heir, not a foreign policy wonk. Mm-hmm. So, Bobby Ghosh, do you agree with Felicia's assessment? This is essentially about Trump's ego and seemingly his obsession with expanding U.S. territory. I mean, do you put some stock in the resources explanation or the defense explanation?
I think Felicia is exactly right. This is about legacy. Trump wants to go down in history as somebody who greatly expanded America's footprint in the world. And this is a way to do that. I think the security argument I find very specious, because only 2 months ago, the Trump administration released its annual threat perception report. And there was no mention of Greenland. In that, it's just 2 months ago, and so now suddenly Greenland is crucial to America's security. Remember that report came from the Trump administration; it did not come from the Biden administration. So that's a direct contradiction of what the administration has said before. The minerals argument, you know, I've heard that argument so often. I've seen that made in so many other places. There used to be reports, and when I covered the war in Iraq, there were reports of huge untapped resources under the desert in western Iraq. There was this talk of there being massive amounts of oil sitting under the desert of Anbar province. Never happened. There used to be these reports, and there were numbers attached to them, $1 trillion worth of minerals under the ground in Afghanistan. And this was used for a while to justify the American presence there. Turns out, not true. So I'm very, very skeptical about these explanations. I will also say, though, that for a decision, for a blunder of this scale, it usually is more than one reason. So yeah, Perhaps the safest option is to say all of the above. But I think the dominant sort of impetus here is of Trump's desire to have legacy. He wants it to go down in the history books with his name attached to it, as something he did.
Yeah, and I zoom out and I think about sort of these reasons that the Trump administration puts up for its certain actions. And I think about Venezuela, where originally, you know, the American people were told it was because of the drug trade that we were attacking ships. Now it's sort of shifted to, you know, oil and it looks like regime change. And so I want to get your thoughts on Venezuela. And so how you see that foreign policy decision and sort of link it to what he's doing in Greenland, because we're trying to see, is this sort of one-off situations or is there some kind of tie, a overall global strategy here, Felicia?
I think this all falls under the category of the Donroe Doctrine that you mentioned on top. I think, you know, Venezuela isn't really regime change, actually. They replaced Maduro, who they felt, you know, they couldn't work with and wasn't compliant. But they've kept the architecture of his government so far. Delcy Rodriguez, who is the kind of acting president, was a very close Maduro ally. But they've basically figured out and you know, they've kind of, there's been all this kind of like behind the scenes negotiations and assessments and all of this, but basically they've assessed her to be someone who will kind of do what they say, right? They've held the threat of more military action over her head, but basically she's more or less taking dictation from the Trump administration about how to be a steward over at least like the country's natural resources. And so I think for Trump, you know, he wants to be in control of his own hemisphere, and he wants kind of pliant cooperative leaders who can do that. So I think in the case of Venezuela, now at least temporarily, I think it remains to be seen. And of course, at some point in the next 6 months or so, Venezuela is supposed to constitutionally have an election. You know, I think there's some who think maybe that will be the transition over to Venezuela's, you know, rightfully elected democratic opposition. You know, maybe not. We'll have to see. And then I think Greenland also, the U.S. considers that to be part of the Western Hemisphere. The team at the White House who's dealing with this is not the Europe team. It's the Western Hemisphere team who's like taking meetings and dealing with this. So again, I think some of it, of course, is kind of Trump's desire to leave a legacy. I do think there are some legitimate security concerns in Greenland. It's just that under the NATO alliance and through the kind of treaties and everything that the U.S. has with all of its partners, they don't need to take over Greenland to address those things. They could send more troops to Greenland tomorrow. There's a lot of things they could do to work with their allies and partners to beef up that security. But again, I think I think there's also like there's a long road between, you know, while it's possible, of course, that the U.S. could invade Greenland, I think there's a very long road between now and when the U.S. might actually control it. But I think, again, it's an idea of having control over the hemisphere, having kind of, you know, I think the Trump administration has a dim view of Europe, of the European Union, of how they govern by consensus. They might feel that, you know, they can exercise more control over what goes on there. I mean, Trump's also mentioned his Golden Dome missile defense system. You know, this is a project that is very ambitious, and I think it's debatable how much of it can come into realization. But if there's any project like that, but again, they could station assets for that project without taking control of the islands. But again, this would give them more sway in the hemisphere.
Mike says if the U.S. were really interested in Greenland's strategic value, it would not be allowing its current assets there to fall into disrepair. Mm-hmm. It's clear that the only aim is extractive minerals. That's Mike's take. Phyllis from Wynwood says Republicans in both houses of Congress must stop Trump from acting out his fantasies before he does permanent damage to America and the world's interests. I've had to take the car keys away from my dad. It's hard, very hard. But knowing he could kill or maim himself or others motivated me to do so. I want to bring in a caller now. This is Michael from Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Michael, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
I guess my comment, and it's also a question, is why New York Times, NPR, the guys over at Politico, they constantly refer to Trump as though he's a thinking, rational being. And they go, Trump's bold move here and Trump's strategy here. And if it's to be believed that Trump is the person that is typing these absolutely insane things about our boats landed in Greenland first, clearly he's not capable of creating any strategy. And who we're really dealing with is Miller, Vought, and maybe a little bit of Vance. and they're pulling the strings on a demented puppet who's, I don't know, how far from the grave. These guys, I really blame NPR for talking about it, and I blame the guys over at Politico, and I blame the New York Times for talking about him like he's a thinking being. This guy's really demented. Who would keep him on any job if he was running your studio putting this stuff out?
Yeah.
He would be chunked.
Well, Michael, you don't think Trump personally cares at all about Greenland? You think that's entirely someone else's idea?
I think 90% of what the guy's saying as far as any actual policy things are being wired into him and stuck in front of him at briefings, and then he's told to sharpie it up.
Okay.
And so on.
Thanks, Michael. We got your point, but I have to move it along. Thank you for the call. I mean, I guess that kind of goes against, though, what you were saying, Bobby. Mm-hmm. It is a little hard to tell how much is coming from Trump, his team. There's some part of that dynamic in every administration. But we've been talking a lot about Greenland this hour, and the best I can tell from talking to you guys and reading what I've read out there is that this idea does kind of start in Trump's brain. Now, maybe you could say the Venezuela stuff or the Iran stuff's a little bit different, but I don't know. Bobby, do you agree with that caller, or do you think that this really does come out of Trump's mind and he is driving the bus on this?
Well, as a previous president famously said, the buck stops with him. And so even if some of these ideas come from other parts of the administration, he's the one who articulates them. And not just that, I think there's plenty of evidence that he takes those ideas and then gives them the Trumpian polish, or if that's the right word, or the twist, and usually ratchets up the boldness or the recklessness. I think reckless is a better word here in this context. And that's it's worth remembering that. This is not just some doddering old fool who doesn't know what's being said or done in his name. He very much knows what is said. And now you could say some people of his administration know how to read him, know how to play him, know how to cater to his fantasies and his vanity and get their work done by playing to all of those strengths and weaknesses. But that's true of almost any presidency. A president's job is to articulate an overall vision, and then his underlings, they try to make their individual pet projects fit into that vision and apply that lens to what they're doing. That's happened in every presidency I've looked at in my adult life. Does it happen more with this one? Or we'll know when the time comes, when all the documents are unsealed, and we'll get a clearer idea. But for the moment, I'm not inclined to say this is all coming from Stephen Miller or Vance or anybody else. This some of the germs of some of these ideas may come from these other people. None of this gets done without Trump signing up for it.
Yeah. By the way, Mary says this push to acquire Greenland is Trump's segue out of NATO. It is telling that yesterday Russia posted that Trump would go down in history if he acquires Greenland. Clearly, Trump is Putin's puppet. That's according to Mary. We've been talking about how allies would react or are dealing with this whole shift and the impact on them long term. I want to talk about adversaries, just sort of how you see adversaries looking at the Trump moves within the Western Hemisphere and some of the foreign policy decisions that he is making. Love to get your thoughts on that, Felicia, and then Bobby. And we only have a couple minutes left, so.
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. I think for them, I think they, Trump kind of strongman reign over the hemisphere, I think is a lot more of a comfortable frame of reference for, say, a Xi Jinping or a President Putin. And I think that, you know, someone like Putin feels like he can kind of hold out and make a deal with Trump at some point when it's advantageous to him. And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, sometimes it's easier for them to understand Trump, but I also think that this is just a complete pivot away from what the U.S. has been trying to do, which is the idea being that if you shape the world in America's image, there'll be more free markets, and that will be good for American consumers and American businesses. And this is something different than that.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Bobby, on how adversaries are viewing these foreign policy moves by the Trump administration?
I think we could do a whole show on just that question, honestly, but I'll put it briefly in a couple of things. I think Putin and Russia, Putin's Russia would be very pleased with this because they want chaos, and they've been sowing chaos in the world actively for more than a decade, nearly two decades now. And the Russian economy, the Russian political system is designed for chaos. China is a different piece, different animal altogether. I think the Chinese have benefited from order, from the very order that America created. China's great wealth and its great success over the last generation does not come in chaos. It comes in order. So the collapse in the world order, particularly the economic order, really hurts China. So I'm very skeptical when people say, well, Xi Jinping is probably very pleased with everything that's going on. I'm not sure that's true. I think Chinese businesses are alarmed and concerned about what, because of the sheer unpredictability of Trump's actions, the Chinese system thrives on predictability. It sees that as the ultimate virtue. So I think two very different visions here. I think the Russians are probably happy for chaos and the Chinese are not.
Well, maybe we'll do that other show someday.
Yeah.
And of course, during that other show, we'd love to get to Iran, which we had to leave on the table this time around because we had so many comments about Greenland and
people
so many interesting thoughts from Bobby Ghosh, columnist on Geo Global Politics, who writes for Foreign Affairs and Time. Bobby, thanks for your time today on Studio 2. And an equal thanks to Felicia Schwartz, diplomatic correspondent for Politico. Felicia, wonderful insights. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everybody who wrote in today and to our caller. And of course, thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Jersey, we're coming your way.